good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're listening to episode 556 of Unwelcome Guests, Redefining Poverty. I'm Robin Upton. One of my original motivations to come to Bangladesh was to help out because it was a poor country. Now, my understanding has moved on a lot since those days, and I've come to see that if it is a poor country, that's mainly because it sees itself as a poor country. Now, it's no exaggeration to say that primary age children are taught this in school. I know that because I've examined the textbooks. They've taught a lot of other junk as well, and it can be seen as a kind of modern day replacement for teaching the natives that they are born inferior, hence the dark skin, as a kind of crypto-colonialism. Because if the world plays by the IMF's money system's rules, then there's a small number of countries who basically run the show, and a large number who, however much debt they repay, never seem to get out of the perpetual payments schedule. Our main presentation this week is by two professors, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, on their 2009 book, The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better. But before we hear that, I'd like us to finish the Ivan Illich reading on needs. Illich looks at phrases and concepts such as the poverty line, the poverty level, and notes that historically these are novel. People never used to see things like that. They never used to have abstracted needs that could be provided for by agencies, consulted upon by experts. And I think his analysis really penetrates through a lot of abstract systems think. It doesn't make a lot of sense to put forward a vision of a more egalitarian, a fairer world, if we do so through the language of hierarchy. So let's get back to reading from episode 554. I'm going to pick up where I left off. This is Illich's unpublished manuscript, I think from 1990, entitled simply Needs. Already in the epoch of steam, the engineer became the symbol of the liberator, a messiah who would lead humanity beyond the reign of necessity. By the end of the 19th century, society became the subject of manipulative engineering. The idea was so infectious that in the 20th century, a pope personally devoted to St. Francis of Assisi, the spouse of Lady Poverty, instructed his faithful on the duty to achieve more. According to the encyclical letter Progressio Populorum of Pope John Paul VI, individual nations must raise the level of the quantity and quality of production to give the life of all their citizens truly human dignity, and give assistance to the common development of the human race. The complete development of the individual must be joined with that of the human race, and must be accomplished by mutual effort. The relation of needs to the development discourse cannot possibly be understood without grasping how recently poverty was first operationalized, and then a poverty line could be defined as the frontier in a war on poverty itself. For Truman, poverty still represented a kind of common floor from which some rise through fortune, industry, or crime. By 1970, the attempts to analyze poverty bestowed on it the characteristics of an economic threshold, and this changed its nature for moderns. It became a measure of a lack in needed income. by defining the poor as those who lack income, which alone can satisfy their needs, that which income buys was surreptitiously reconceptualized as a commodity. Poverty in New York City, as well as in Ethiopia, became an abstract, universal measure of underconsumption. Those who survive in spite of indexed underconsumption were then perceived as victims of a double bind. They cannot fill their income lack through engaging in subsistence activities, and they are condemned to an existence viewed as inhuman and indecent. Economists began to explore the significance of this inelastic threshold. They recognized that it was not possible to speak of economic wants below an income level where demands have become substantially incommensurable. And as a footnote, the poverty line seems to have been coined by the chocolate-producing Quaker philanthropist and friend of Lloyd George, B.S. Rowntree, in 1901. Quote, "The recipients of charity are the poor, i.e. those who, from causes primary or secondary, are below the poverty line." The same expression was also used during the same year by Winston Churchill. Only in the 50s it was adopted for the construction of an indicator by the U.S. Department of Labor. The synonym poverty level has been adopted more recently. According to the NOED, it appears in the New York Times, February 2, 1976. Page 13, it is said that 24.3 million Americans, more than 10% of the population, were classified as poor in 1974. From 23 million in 1971, the poverty level is defined by the Department of Labor. In 1978, the New York Times speaks about 1 million in West Germany living below the poverty level. People who live below the absolute poverty line have no power to behave according to economic rationality. They cannot afford to trade food against shelter or clothing or tools. The new category of economic cripples, thus defined, may in fact survive, but they do not fully participate in the characteristics of Homo economicus. They exist all over the world, but they are marginal, not just to the economy, but to humanity itself. Since the latter, from the time of Mandeville, has been defined in terms of the ability to make choices under the assumption of scarcity. Under a different guise, people also entered the development discourse earlier. From a United Nations publication in 1962, quote, "While at the beginning of the 1950s, the problem of developing countries was viewed essentially as a problem of productive wealth, by the end of that decade it became widely acknowledged that the crucial factor was not production, but rather the capacity to produce, which is inherent in people." Unquote. At that time, then, it became legitimate to speak about people as one of the ingredients of economic growth. It was no longer necessary to speak separately of economic and social development, since development, as distinct from growth, should automatically include both. Insufficiently qualified or capitalized people were increasingly mentioned as a burden or brake on development. This third evolutionary step, which integrates the people factor into economic growth calculus, has a history of its own. In the mid-50s, influential economists had begun to argue that certain components of medical and educational services should not be understood as personal consumption because they were necessary prerequisites of economic development. The great difference in the results of similar development policies at the same level of monetary income could not be explained without paying attention to the investments made in human beings. The quality and distribution of training, physical well-being, social discipline, and participation levels came to be called, quote, the residual factor, unquote. Independent of the amount of capital and labor available, economic development seemed to hinge on these social qualifications of people for jobs. During the 70s, Two empirical observations qualified the concept of human capital developed in the 60s. On one hand, the assumption that the value of education or medical services is reflected in manpower qualification lost much of its credibility. On the other, the labour theory of value lost its meaning. Even in the weak terms in which it had entered mainstream economics, it became obvious that, irrespective of available manpower qualifications, the modernised sector could not be made sufficiently labour-intensive to provide enough jobs to justify the economically necessary redistribution of incomes in the form of earnings. No conceivable employment-oriented development strategy could create the work which would employ the lowest third or quarter of the population. As a result, planners during the 1980s transposed the development melody to a fourth key. Under various designations, they undertook the economic colonization of the informal sector. New stress was put on incentives for activities that would keep people busy in the black market, in the barter economy, or self-supporting in the traditional sector. Above all, shadow work became quantitatively more important, not just in fact, but also in policy. By shadow work, I mean that performance of unpaid activities that, in a market-intensive society, are necessary to transform purchased commodities into consumable goods. Finally, self-help activities, which in the 60s smacked of second best, became a favourable growth sector of planners and organisers during the 80s. This is the context within which the resuscitation of the discourse on needs must be interpreted. Development can be visualized as a process by which people are lifted out of their traditional cultural commons. In this transition, cultural bonds are dissolved, even though culture continues development in superficial ways. One need only observe rural people recently transplanted to the megacities of the Third World. Development can be imagined as a draft that blows people off their feet, out of their familiar space, places them on an artificial platform, a new structure of living. In order to survive on this exposed and raised foundation, people are compelled to achieve new minimum levels of consumption, for example, in formal education, public health measures, frequency in the use of transportation, rental housing. The overall process, usually couched in the language of engineering, the creation of infrastructures, the building and coordination of systems, various growth stages, social escalators. Even rural development is discussed in this urban language. Under the heavy weight of the new structures, the cultural bedrock of poverty cannot remain intact. It cracks. People are forced to live on a fragile crust, below which something unprecedented and inhuman lurks. In traditional poverty, people could rely on finding a cultural hammock, and there was always the ground level to depend on, as a squatter or beggar. This side of the grave, no one could sink below ground. Hell was a real pit, but it was for those who had not shared with the poor in this life to be suffered after death. This no longer holds. Modernized dropouts are neither beggars nor bums. They are victimized by the needs attributed to them by some poverty pimp. They have fallen through the poverty line, and each passing year diminishes their chances of ever rising again above the line. Welfare is not a cultural hammock. It is an unprecedented mediation of scarce resources through agents who not only define what need is and certify where it exists, but also closely supervise its remedy, with or without the needy's approval. Insurance is not reliance on community support in case of disaster. Rather, it is one of the ultimate forms of political control in a society in which protection against future risks is valued higher than access to present satisfaction or joy. needs discussed as criteria for development strategies clearly have nothing to do with either traditional necessities or desires, as I suggested above. Nevertheless, during the second and third development decades, poverty came to be defined in terms of unmet, operationalized needs. And all of this occurred in spite of the fact that for the mainstream economist, need is a non-word. Economic theory does not acknowledge that there are such things as needs. Further, economics cannot say much that is useful about desires, preferences, and demands. But need, presumably, is a moral, psychological, or physical imperative which brooks no compromise or adjustment, or economic analysis. Most economists, up to today, declare themselves incompetent to include needs in their analysis, and prefer to leave the needs discussion to philosophers or politicians. On the other hand, a growing number of economists critical of conventional development theory and practice found in basic needs the foundation for what came to be called the new economic order. They thought to find in needs the term for non-negotiable, mutually incommensurable requirements of human nature. These had to be provided for by the economy before economic preferences, choices, and wants could be effectively formulated. But before the concept of needs could be incorporated in economic argument, it had to be defined and classified. For this undertaking, Abraham Maslow's theory of a needs hierarchy suddenly became very influential indeed. Physical, safety, affection, esteem, and ultimately self-realization needs underlay most current discussion as the key categories. Unlike wants, which, since Hobbes, are considered as equal, since they're simply what people want, needs are consistently discussed as fitting into an objective hierarchy. They are generally spoken about as realities to be disinterestedly studied by needs experts, and which can, in some way, lead to the definition of a universal ethics. For example, Eric Fromm believes that the sane society is an arrangement that, quote, corresponds to the needs of man, not necessarily to what he feels to be his needs, because even the most pathological aims can be felt subjectively as that which the person wants most, but to what his needs are objectively, as they can be ascertained by the study of man, unquote. Up to now, the most complete critical study of the needs discourse and its implications has been made by Marianne Grönemeyer. More clearly than anyone else, she has demonstrated that needs, in the current sense, are a new way of formulating the assumption of universal scarcity. Further, she shows that needs, defined under the guise of science, permit the redefinition of human nature according to the convenience and interest of professionals who administer and serve them. Of particular interest is the role played by basic needs in the transformation of economic man into needy man, a process which coincides directly with the redefinition of poverty in recent development theory. Development is based on the belief that necessity can be cancelled by engineering audacity, literally utopian, nowhere. Development takes off beyond a minimal level of consumption determined by scientific insights into human nature. To share in a meaningful way in the benefits of this development, one must first consume a certain minimum amount of basic services, largely paid for by taxes and or borrowing from future generations. One needs a prescribed amount of education, healthcare, news, transportation, protection, administration, in order to be human enough to share this new world. But, quoting from Marianne Grönemeyer's Die Macht der Bedürfnisse, Reflexionen über ein Phantom, The Power of Needs, Reflections on a Phantom, insistence on basic needs is inevitably double-edged. It implies that you can become either more or less human. Needs define humanity as divisible. unquote. And, as another has also clearly seen, quoting Agnes Heller, The Theory of Needs in Marx, speaking about needs, she says, quote, they define the individual and reduce it to the profile of its needs, unquote. For Talcott Parsons, already in 1951, quote, personality is to be viewed as the establishment of a relatively specific, definite, and consistent need disposition, unquote. As Michael Ignatieff has pointed out, no other age has had a term or idea which occupied that place in its constellation of meanings which need now occupies in ours. Certainly needs are not the necessities of Adam Smith, who writes in Wealth of Nations, quote, required by the support of life, and in addition, whatever the custom of the country renders indecent for creditable people, even of the lowest order, to be without. Custom has rendered leather shoes necessary for life in England. The poorest creditable person of either sex would be ashamed to appear in public without them. In Scotland, custom has rendered them a necessity of life of the lowest order of men, but not to the same order of women, who may, without any discredit, walk about barefooted. In France, they are necessary neither to men nor to women. Unquote. This passage bespeaks a world in which, firstly, moral relations between strangers were modified by custom or culture, and secondly, status defined necessities, which precisely for these two reasons are not basic needs. Today, the attempt to insert moral sense in the development discourse must rescind customary, we would say cultural, norms which Smith could take for granted. And anything approaching the character of moral statement within the ever more radically amoral context of developed societies must resort to a new kind of appeal not formulated according to custom. This situation brings out and partially legitimates the professional. He is uniquely positioned to know what strangers need, much better than the clients themselves, for they are bound to be misled by the vestiges of their traditional cultural traits. Unquestioningly, the basic needs approach to development does provide criteria, truly new ones, for formulating institutional claims based on the imputed needs of the weakest, who, by definition, are those without the acquired ability to recognize their own misery as a result of their unmet needs. The metaphor or model for the modern needs expert is the physician. He, rather than the patient, knows what the latter needs because, more often than not, the disease is the result of the patient's own behavior. The principal task of the needs diagnostician coincides with that of the modern doctor. He must educate those he serves to accept his views and comply with his prescriptions. In the 1970s, participation and advocacy were still unsullied terms. Experts presented themselves as servants who helped the poor become conscious of their true needs, as a big brother to assist them in the formulation of their claims. This welfare dream of bleeding hearts and blue-eyed do-gooders can today be easily dismissed as the nonsense of an age already past. Needs in a vastly more interdependent, complex, polluted, and crowded world can no longer be identified and quantified, except through intense teamwork scrutiny of system specialists. And in this new world, the needs discourse becomes the preeminent device to reduce people into individual units with input requirements. We are at a threshold of a still unnoticed transformation from a political consciousness based on progress, growth, and development, rooted in the dreams of the Enlightenment, to a new, yet unnamed consciousness, defined by controls which ensure a sustainable system of need satisfaction. Development is dead, yes, but the experts who gave us needs are now busily at work reconceptualizing their gift to us, redefining humanity yet again. To survive, they say, we must now see ourselves, not as citizens, but as cyborgs, in the image of immune systems, infinitesimally small units, in a series of inclusive systems ending no one knows where. The all-important factor is best understood not as need but as requirement, the complex of requirements for each system. If this view comes to prevail, then men and women will indeed cease to be. Some years ago, the promoters of development promised more, thus creating the psychic condition for the implantation of needs, which led to the creation of a needy addict, a being in whom we all share. Perhaps the new systems experts can be outwitted through the moral courage necessary to kick bad habits. I hope that wasn't too abstract. I've found many people who are attracted to the idea of a post-money world still have real difficulty to orientate themselves and understand how that could work. And I think a lot of it is from internalizing ideas such as poverty in an abstract and a numerical sense, which are inherently depersonalizing and which actually obscure the ongoing realities of people's lives. Now let's hear the soundtrack of a video recorded by Pirate TV from June 2010 in Seattle Town Hall, and the introduction is by Dr. Stephen Bezruchka.
I first came to ask the question about 20 years ago, what makes a population healthy? And it's kind of interesting. So I just today searched that phrase, so what makes a population healthy? And the first five hits I came up with were all my stuff. So I've spent the last 15 years trying to answer that question, what makes a population healthy? And how do you get into that kind of information? I went back to public health school after working as a doctor for 20 years to try and answer that question, and I left kind of depressed because the people at Johns Hopkins weren't really interested in that about 17 years ago. I did, however, come across an editorial in a journal that I filed and I highlighted saying that inequality had something to do with the health of populations. And I just filed it away, and then about a year later I saw a graph, and then I sourced the graph, and then I said, well, what is this idea that inequality is somehow linked to our health as a population? So I wrote a letter to the author of that study and said, what about poor countries? Could this work there? And so we started a correspondence that led to some time spent together. And along the way, Richard Wilkinson broadened the question. Besides the health of a population, what else does inequality influence? And so he joined up with Kate Pickett to address this broader question. And the more they looked, the more they found, and I can't think of a more compelling series of issues surrounding our well-being as a society that are linked to the hierarchical structure. So we're really lucky tonight in having Richard and Kate here. They wrote a book that was a bestseller in Europe that has come out in a United States edition this just last December, and it's titled The Spirit Level. And it's kind of interesting. You might ask Richard and Kate what this title means, but what does this have to do with our well-being as a society? Kate is a professor of epidemiology at the University of York, and Richard is a retired professor of social epidemiology at the University of Nottingham. Now, how many of you know anything about the region around Nottingham? Who is a famous person who lived? Robin Hood in Sherwood Forest, yes, yes. So please welcome Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who will talk about their book, The Spirit Level.
Yes, I'm turned on. Good. I hope I'm going to turn you on. It's nice to see. It's really encouraging to see so many people on such a wet night. Thank you all for turning out. What I'm going to be talking about with Kate is really something I've been obsessed by for a long time. And you get a bit worried that maybe this is bee in my bonnet and, you know, I think it's important, but maybe nobody else does. And so it's been actually extraordinarily reassuring to find that suddenly this is being taken up, at least at home, and judging by audiences like yourselves and others we've had recently, perhaps here too. What we're going to do, first me, then Kate, and then I'll come back at the end, is, I think, tell you what you already know. By which I mean that I think everyone has had, at least a great many people, an intuition that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive. You know, that goes back, you can see it in the, you know, equality, liberty, fraternity, equality in the French Revolution. And what I think the data we're going to show you tells us is that that intuition is extraordinarily true. I had worked for a great many years on a tendency for more equal countries, that's countries with smaller income differences between rich and poor, to be healthier. But I was very slow to realize that that might apply not just to ill health, which is more common in the poorest areas of our society, but to a whole range of other social problems which have the same pattern. So we're going to take you through that data. The differences are extraordinarily large. I mean, you find huge differences in homicide rates and drug abuse and child well-being and so on from one rich country to another. And that is partly because these effects of inequality don't just affect the poor. They affect almost all of us to different degrees. And so what we're really talking about is the real quality of life for the vast majority of the populations now in the rich developed countries. I'm going to start with a slide which really draws attention to a paradox, that income means very little anymore, but if you could look at the differences in average income levels between the rich developed countries, and yet they're very important within our societies. So here you have national income per person, and life expectancy. And these little grey dots that might be, I don't know, tiny clouds from where you're sitting, are the names of the rich developed countries. So there's Japan, and if I get a little bit closer, there's Sweden, Spain, Israel, Greece, UK, USA is there, Norway. Rich developed market democracies. And you see some of them are twice as rich as others. And the currencies are converted at, in a way to take account of prices in those different countries. So people in these countries can buy twice as much of everything as people in those countries, and yet it makes no difference at all to life expectancy. That is despite knowing that health is much worse in the poorest inner city areas and so on. And yet in between, within each of these countries is a social gradient in health like that. These are age-adjusted mortality rates of white men in US zip code areas. It's rather old data. They're classified by the median income of the zip code areas, so they're the richest ones with low death rates and the poorest ones with high death rates. And this isn't just a difference between the poor and the rest of society. It's a difference all the way across the society. It often seems to me that this is one of the biggest human rights or social justice issues facing modern societies, that huge difference in life expectancy. It varies. In some societies, there's a sort of 3, 4, 5 year difference in life expectancy between top and bottom. In others, it might be 15 years or even more. But anyway, what this paradox draws our attention to, that income is important within societies but not between them, is that we're dealing with relative income, relative poverty, inequality, social status, social position, the differences between us, something like that. So keep that in mind, because we're going to be talking about inequality, the changes in the size of the differences between us. You may be surprised, of course, to show that I show you there's no difference between life, no relationship between life expectancy and national income in the rich developed countries. But of course, the poor countries, economic growth is really important. And in the early stages of economic growth, life expectancy improves very fast. I was just showing you these countries out here. You know, having more money, more food, more of everything, more better shelter, better clothing is really important in the poorer countries. But when you get to the rich developed countries, it doesn't help us anymore. Interestingly, if I showed you a graph of happiness, it would look almost exactly the same. You'd have to read the labels to be sure which you were looking at. So instead of life expectancy here, put happiness here. Important rises in the early stages of development and then petering out. If you look at well-being within our societies over a period of time when perhaps levels of income double or treble, you find levels of measures of well-being are completely flat, unresponsive to our economic growth. We are the first generation to get to the end of what economic growth can do for us. It's been much the most important way of raising the real quality of human life for centuries. But we've got to the end of that. And we've got to the end of it just at the time when we realize how damaging further economic growth is for the environment and the need to rein in carbon emissions by perhaps 80 or 90% in the rich developed countries. We're going to talk a lot about inequality, but we're never talking about any hypothetical level of, perfect equality or anything like that. What we're doing is comparing the differences in inequality between different rich developed societies. The measure we use is how much richer the top 20% in each country than the bottom 20%. And these are the countries for which we have good data. And you see in the most equal countries, Japan, Finland, Norway, Sweden, the top 20% in each of those countries is 3.5 or 4 times as rich. In the more unequal countries, the UK, Portugal, the USA, they're 7, 8, 8.5 times as rich. So we are, on that measure, twice as unequal as these countries. And what we're going to be doing is show you the implications of that, showing you the effects that has on the quality of social life and the way our societies work. I think increasingly people are perhaps worried about the contrast between the material success of our societies, despite the recession, and the social failings. And I think if we'd been living in the 19th century and we'd heard about the sort of standard of living which was coming in 100 years' time, we'd have thought, you know, life is going to be just so wonderful. It's really hard to believe that we're going to be worried about crime and violence and drug abuse and teenage births and, you know, all the other problems, mental illness, things like that. But actually that's what we're preoccupied with. The media is just full of social problems all the time. There's prison overcrowding. This is teenage births, antisocial behavior, drug abuse, all sorts of things that we worry about, uneasy about the social development of our societies. Kate and I collected data wherever we could find comparable data from reputable sources for health and social problems of the kind which you expect to be worse in the more in the poorest areas of our society. Problems with those social gradients that I showed you, like the health ones. We got data for life expectancy in each country. We got children's maths and literacy scores, which you can compare between countries. Infant mortality rates, homicide rates, levels of imprisonment, what proportion of the population is imprisoned in each country, teenage birth rates, levels of trust, that's how much people feel they can trust others, obesity rates, mental illness, including drug and alcohol addiction, and social mobility. That was just initially all we could find socially comparable, internationally comparable data on. We put them all into one index, and what we called our index of health and social problems. So a sort of rag bag of whatever we had found. And they're weighted equally. So where a country is influenced as much by trust as it is by homicides or how kids do get on at school. And here you see it related to income inequality. That measure I've just shown you. So on the right-hand end are the more unequal countries, which have worse outcomes in terms of this, all these health and social problems in the index. And at the more equal end, countries doing much, much better. That doesn't look like a correlation out of the social sciences. It looks like physics with a bit of measurement error. And it really is, it's extraordinarily close. You know, every little step rise in inequality produces more of all these problems. And interestingly, if you put that same index of health and social problems in relation to national income per person instead of inequality, there's no relationship. I sometimes think people think there's a beginning to be a suggestion of relationship down there, but that's only because Portugal's there. And don't forget the USA is up there. Statistically, there's no relationship at all. We were rather surprised by the strength of these relationships with inequality, and although we can tell from the statistics that these aren't just chance findings, can't be dismissed as chance, we thought we should test it all out in a second setting. So as well as that international set of international comparisons, we also looked at the same question in the 50 states of the USA, asking the same question. Do the more equal states do better on all these things? And the picture is very substantially the same. It's not such a close fit, but it's highly statistically significant, a tendency for the more unequal states to have worse outcomes on almost exactly the same index of health and social problems. We managed to get almost all those variables that go into it for the 50 states. We were also worried that people might think that we'd chosen problems to suit our argument. So we thought, we did a paper in the British Medical Journal on the United Nations Index of Child Wellbeing in rich countries. That was important for us simply because we did not compile that index. We did not choose what went into it. In fact, it has 40 different components. They include things like whether kids can talk to their parents and is the bullying at school. How do they get on in these maths and literacy tests? What are immunization rates like? So all sorts of aspects of child well-being go into that United Nations index. And there it is in relation to inequality. Again, a strong relationship. USA, exactly the levels of child well-being that would be predicted from its levels of inequality. The UK doing substantially worse than we'd predict for our levels of inequality. We're doing worst of all there. But look at these countries up here, how well they're doing. Put that same UNICEF index of child well-being in relation to national income per person, and there's absolutely no relationship. We talk about child poverty as the problem, but that doesn't mean economic growth is going to solve it, even if we have trickle down. If the whole society gets richer together, it does nothing for children. What child well-being needs is reducing the differences between us. It's a matter of how far behind the rest of us they are. I'm going to now hand over to Kate, who will show you some of the features of the different components of that index.
Hello, I thought you were going to hand me over to them. To the angry mob. I'm afraid you might be an angry mob by the time I finish, but I hope not with me. I lived here in the USA for 16 years, and it's nice to be back. But I'm afraid I am going to show you slide after slide after slide where you guys are at the bottom. That one that Richard just showed you where we're at the bottom, I think that's probably the only one. No, I'm exaggerating a little bit. And it's lovely to be in Seattle tonight and to meet, first time in a long time, one of my students who's here. and to see that she's come out on a rainy night to listen to this, as have all of you. She should probably get home working on her dissertation. So we can have a chat about that later. All right, we'll start with levels of trust. These are different countries, and up the side here we have the proportion of people in those countries who think that most others can be trusted. And these data are collected by the World Value Survey, and what they do is they go to different countries and they take random samples of the population and they ask them, do you think most other people can be trusted? Or do you think they're out for themselves? And up here we have Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland, the Netherlands, and around two-thirds of the population think that others can be trusted. And down at the bottom end here, actually you're not doing so badly on that one, are you? But it's around a fifth of the population. So that's the scale of the difference. And I want you to think about what it feels like to live in those different places, to be in a place where if you're out on the street, encountering strangers, walking home alone as a woman, travelling on public transport, working in different institutions, what it feels like if you know that the vast majority of the people you meet trust you and you feel you can trust them, compared to a society where only a small minority of people feel they can trust others. And here are levels of trust in the 50 US states. And these data come from your General Social Survey, which does exactly the same thing as the World Values Survey internationally. Random samples of the population in each state ask the same question, do you think most other people can be trusted or not? And the scale of differences is really similar. Up here at the more equal end, there's New Hampshire, Utah, Wisconsin, Iowa, Vermont, North Dakota. Again, around two-thirds of the population thinking that other people can be trusted. And down at the more unequal end, it's more like a third. So the same scale of differences, the same range of kinds of society, the same feelings associated with being in a very trusting place, one that's public-spirited, socially cohesive, community-minded, compared to one where very few people feel like that. Let's move on to mental illness. These data come from the World Health Organization's consortium, which is set up to measure mental illness in different countries so that we can compare it. And at the side here, we've got the percent of the population who've had some kind of mental illness in the past year. This is the adult population. And down here at the more equal end, here's Japan, Germany, Spain, it's less than 10% of the adult population who've had some kind of illness in the past 12 months. Up here, Australia, the UK, 23% of our adult population have been mentally ill in the past year. And for you, it's 26%, so more than one in four. And the scale of those differences tell you something really important. We're not looking at a problem here confined to the poorest segment of our population. We're not looking at a problem here confined to a small minority group. 26% of the population is too big to be explained by what's going on at the very bottom or in any particular subgroups. Moving on to physical health. These are death rates for working age men, and the green dots are US states. They're bigger if the state has a large population and smaller if it's smaller. And then down at the more equal end, those red ones are the Canadian provinces. They all tend to be more equal than the US states. And you can see a strong tendency for lower levels of mortality in the more equal states and provinces. And there have been close to 200 studies of the effect of income inequality on physical health. And it's a very robust relationship. Here are levels of violence. These are murder rates. And just as there have been a lot of studies of income inequality and health, there have been about 50 studies at least of income inequality and violent crime. Again, these are the US states. Those are the circles, if you can tell. And I'm not sure if you'll be able to distinguish, but the Canadian provinces are down here and they're triangles. Here, this is the more unequal end, and here's the more equal end. And down at the more equal end in these Canadian provinces, there are about 15 murders per million people per year. And up at the more unequal end here, it's about 150 per million people per year. So a tenfold difference, closely related to levels of inequality. And here are teenage birth rates. Down at the lower end, Japan, Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, here, fewer than 10 births per 1,000 young women aged 15 to 19. The UK has the worst teenage birth rate in Europe, and there's the USA up here, somewhere close to 50. And actually, the differences are even starker or more important than you can see in this graph. Down here in Japan, which has got the lowest rate, over 80% of those young women are actually, they're married. In the UK and in the USA, it's sort of the reverse. The vast majority of our teen mums are unmarried and having their babies in very different kind of social context. And here's drug use. We got these data from the United Nations. It's an index of opiates, cocaine, cannabis, ecstasy, and amphetamine. So illegal drug use. We've put them into an index, and we find a significant tendency for the more unequal countries to have a higher level of drug use than the more equal ones. And here's rates of imprisonment. This one looks very like the figure Richard showed you earlier of our index of health and social problems. It's such a tight, close relationship. If you know a country's level of inequality, you can pretty accurately predict its level of imprisonment. Now, this is on a slightly different scale than we use for all our other graphs. This one's on a log scale. And that means the difference between 10 and 100 on this scale is the same as between 100 and 1,000. And we've had to do that, I'm afraid, to fit you on. Because otherwise the relationship would curve there somewhere. And of course the only other one that wouldn't be useful to make an accurate prediction from is Greece, which has an unusually low level of imprisonment. And it should be even lower because two of them escaped recently. And the only reason we know that was because it was a big story in our news back home, because they did it rather spectacularly. A helicopter landed in the prison yard and they got in and flew away. That wasn't actually the most spectacular bit of the story. The most spectacular bit was it was the second time they'd done it. But it's not really funny, is it, this? And rates of imprisonment aren't particularly closely correlated with crime rates. What we're seeing here is a tendency for more unequal societies to have harsher judicial systems, to be more likely to send people to prison who come into the criminal justice system, and for them to be more likely to send them away for longer. In the UK, our crime rates have been coming down, and our prison rates have been skyrocketing. Here are rates of imprisonment in your states. We've coloured in red the ones that have retained the death penalty and in blue those that have abolished it. And you can see a tendency for the more equal states to have abolished the death penalty. But again, the scale of differences between equal and unequal states is large, around 200 prisoners per 100,000 in the more equal ones, more like 700 in the most unequal states. And here's child conflict. This is an index of the percentage of kids who report having been fighting in different countries, they've been aggressive towards other children, combined with the proportion of those who say they have been bullied, somebody has been aggressive to them, along with the proportion of those who find that their peers aren't kind or helpful. And so we can see that the lack of trust and the levels of violence being measured in the adult population are also being experienced by our children, with significantly higher levels of conflict in the more unequal countries than in the more equal ones. And here's education. We could have showed you educational scores on maths and literacy tests, comparing different countries and comparing different states. But this one is the proportion of kids who drop out of high school. So down in the more equal states, it's 10 to 15% of kids who drop out without finishing, and up in the more unequal states, it's around a quarter. And here's the last of my sort of individual components of our index of health and social problems. This is social mobility, which is a hard thing to measure. And what's been done here, and these data were produced by researchers at the London School of Economics, is a measure that correlates a father's income when his son is born with the son's income 30 years later. So it's intergenerational income mobility. Do rich parents have rich children? Or not particularly? And up here, where the correlation is low, so social mobility is high, we have Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Canada, and Germany. We don't have these data for many countries because not many countries have collected that kind of information for long enough. But down here, here's the UK and the land of opportunity and the American dream. So those are all of the individual components. We've shown you them separately just to give you an idea of the scale of the differences and the consistency of the patterns. But the next point we want to make is that almost all of us benefit from living in a more equal society. And that although the benefits are greatest for the poorest among us, they extend all the way up the population. It's hard to do these kinds of studies as well, because you need to be able to compare people at the same socioeconomic position in different countries. And that's quite hard to do. But there have been some studies that give us this kind of information. These are data on chronic diseases in white men from England and white men from the USA. Here for diabetes, here for hypertension, cancer, lung disease, and heart disease. And within each group of English men and American men, they're divided into those with the lowest third of education, the middle third, and the highest third. And so you can see generally there's a tendency for the most educated to be doing better than the least educated. But always, it's better to be in slightly more equal England than the more unequal USA, even for the men in the top third of education. And here's some similar information from our own work in the United States. What we're looking up at the side here are death rates for US counties. It's about 3,000 counties here. And they're divided into those in more equal states and less equal states. And they're arranged by county median income, average income. So here, among the poorer counties, there's a clear benefit of living in a more equal state. Death rates are lower than in less equal states. But that difference extends all the way up the population, and even in the most affluent counties, there's a benefit from living in a more equal state than a less equal one. And here's some education from some evidence from education. These are literacy scores of young adults. In more equal Sweden, Canada, which comes in about the middle of the income inequality distribution, and the more unequal United States. And at this end are the educational scores of the least educated parents. And there's a big difference. It's much, much more important to be in more equal Sweden than in more unequal United States. But all the way up, even among the most educated parents, there's a difference in how well their children score on these literacy tests. So I hope we've made the case to you now that income inequality is related to a whole range of health and social problems and that the benefits extend to the majority of the population. But I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about the importance of equality as we move into an era where we need to cope with climate change and develop more sustainable economies. And Richard mentioned at the beginning how important it is for us to recognise that that's one of the reasons we have to deal with coming to the end of what economic growth can do for us. One of the really important things that happens in a more unequal society is that as the social distances get stretched out between us, status becomes more important, and competing for status becomes more important. And how do we demonstrate our status in our modern societies? We shop. We want bigger houses, we want better cars, we want clothes with designer labels on. Some of us, not me, want handbags that cost $1,000. We want the trappings of status. We want to show that we can compete, that we can keep up. But we know that we need to rein in consumerism. That's one of the most important things we're going to have to do to deal with carbon emissions. And there's some evidence that backs this up, that status competition becomes more important in more unequal countries. Look how much longer working hours are in the more unequal countries.